Hello, and welcome to another week of Tactical Tips. I'm Rich.
I'm Pat.
I'm Tom. And this week, we'll continue on the topic of Grimkin, especially focusing on Dark Menagerie. And we'll go into depth on the casters of Grimkin this week. And on my part, I think we mostly see Dark Menagerie with like Heretic and Dreamer. And nowadays, people expand it into playing with the Wonder, the Child, and some King of Nothing. What do you think, Pat?
Yeah, definitely. I think Dark Menagerie is a strong enough theme force on its own that you can run it with any caster in the faction. Obviously, Grimkin, a limited faction, they've got 6 casters to choose from, but all of them bring something unique to that theme force, and they help it in different ways. Which is really, really interesting. And you can definitely, like, the list itself often won't change very much, but the caster you take is what might end up tweaking your list in a certain direction, right? Whether or not you want to tech for improved armor cracking, resilience, being better against guns, having higher threat ranges. It's your casters that will do that for you more than the units you take.
Can you, for each of the casters, Pat, can you summarize what that does to the list? Because it sounds like it's quite defined, i.e. armor cracking, range, things like that.
Yeah, it is a little bit defined, but it's interesting because every caster gives a mix of benefits. The way I like to think of it is, in Grimkin, you have threat range extenders, and a lot of the casters can give a +2 threat range, but it's very hard to get more than that. So you have Aldrich 3 gives boundless charge. The Wanderer has Beacon on his lamp. Dreamer has Mirage. And Child has Abuse. Child actually could do +4 with Tantrum, but Tantrum is triggered by your opponent, so it's not very reliable. So all 4 of those 6 all have a +2-inch threat range buff, right? Whereas Heretic and King of Nothing have no speed buff. Then when it comes to something like damage, you have Fury on the Heretic, you have Scything Touch on King of Nothing, you have Manifest Destiny on Dreamer, and you have, once again, Abuse on Child. And they all give a buff that's around the +2 range, sometimes a little bit better. But they all buff damage pretty reliably. Aldrich can do it as well with Curse of Shadows. But as an offensive debuff, that one is much harder to use effectively. Wanderer kind of does his best by having an accuracy buff on his Flare and a free charge. But he's probably the weakest when it comes to damage stacking. And then when you think about defenses, you have other options as well, right? Wanderer, although he's weakest when it comes to boosting damage, he has Starcrossed. So he is awesome at helping your models survive in melee. And of course, your heavies and even your lights are already very resilient for their points cost. Rattlers, Skinner Moans, and Gorehounds have really, really good defense. So buffing that is really, really strong. And then the other casters have unique defensive abilities. So Aldrich has Windstorm, which reduces the range of attacks in her control area. She can make her control area 18 inches, so she can shut down shooting really hard. The King of Nothing has a Cloud Wall. Dreamer has Artifice of Deviation. Heretic has Wall of Fire. So they all have these unique but different defensive tools. And then, of course, they've got other abilities as well, which will have varying levels of power. But so when I'm thinking about it, what I tend to think of is, do I want a damage buff? Because if I do, I'm probably cutting out Wanderer and maybe Aldrich, because her buff is less reliable. And do I want a speed buff? Because if I do, then I'm cutting out Heretic and I'm cutting out King of Nothing. And then the main thing that I think about is, regardless of those, what other unique abilities that the caster brings are really going to help this list? Yeah, how much use am I going to get out of a Cloud Wall? How much use am I going to get out of this, that, and the other, right? And it's those unique abilities that really let you tech your DM list in a specific direction for a specific matchup.
That makes sense. I mean, looking through those and how you've described them, it looks like they all have a way of doing some important things. So improving damage and protecting their army. Yeah. There's 4 of them that seem to be better than King of Nothing and Wanderer. So King of Nothing with the Cloud Wall, certainly in a world of Haley 3, doesn't seem to do enough when you've got better Cloud Wall casters that are being teched for.
It's interesting you say that, Rich, because I think that's a fair assumption to make, except that King of Nothing has had something of a resurgence recently. He's been very, very popular. In fact, Tom, your teammate was running King of Nothing, right?
Yes, he was.
And that was at the OTC?
Yes.
So how did that list work in Dark Menagerie?
I think is so they're both Cloud Walls, right? Like, obviously, clouds are the same regardless. And his Cloud Walls are a little bit different because he's delivering heavies, which are inherently more powerful than delivering infantry, I think. Because it lets them advance up the board more meaningfully because they're more point investments, and then putting them in good places is more important than putting, like let's say, like five trenches. So, and then he also has the benefit of giving everyone ghostly, so he can avoid the one of the issues sometimes when you deliver heavies behind cloud walls is when the opponent's army jams your lineup, and then he can just cast a host of shadows and then have his models disengage and then have his backline, say, Rattler, clean up the front and then put up the cloud again. So I think that the list is good still in a world where people are taking for cloud walls, because the tools people have to fight Haley 3 will not work generally against King of Nothing, because to tech for Haley 3 you want anti-infantry shooting or anti-infantry tools, whereas King of Nothing, if you bring anti-infantry tools, that see-through cloud is not going to do much against the King of Nothing.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. It's the fact that you have a different kind of skew behind your cloud wall. One of the things that I think is interesting about that list is it's one of the few, it's probably the only Dark Menagerie list archetype, or at least one that's commonly seen, that runs a lot of heavies but doesn't run the death knell. And that's just because the death knell as a battle engine can be seen through all the clouds. Mm. And having a cloud wall plan doesn't work so well when your key support piece can just be shot by the whole army, especially considering King of Nothing has a hard time staying outside of 5 inches of it. And yeah, so we'll often give it an armor debuff as well.
Yeah.
So I think that's actually a really interesting list archetype. I've played it a few times myself, and one of the things that's really cool about it is that between your Arcana and things like Arcane Vortex, you actually have some ways to stop some of the more common anti-cloud tech. Like, a lot of times, people say their list is teched for clouds, and what they mean is they've taken Linus and Adrea, but Adrea's anti-cloud tech is her spell, right? And that can be stopped by Cage Ragers using Arcane Vortex, and it can be stopped by Ruin. So you can continue, you can keep your cloud walls up, and they actually, even their anti-cloud list can't deal with it.
What about the Mistspeaker? So if you have a look at, say, what we talked about a few weeks ago with the Scorn Battle Engines, so that's a piece with Guidance that absolutely loves high-value targets behind clouds because it doesn't care about them, and bigger bases are better. Is that just a case of actually Turtles are good into this list, and that's not thinking Nothing's bad, it's just a worse matchup than most of the rest of the field?
So Ruin still works against the Mistspeaker because Guidance is a spell, so that's really good. You can have a turn, your clouds can buy you a turn, but they definitely can't be your long-term game plan, because you can have a turn's reprieve where Guidance is going to be less effective. And for example, against, for example, Rasheth, Winds of Death, right, the common build has two Siege Animantrax and two Soul Wards to give them both Guidance, right? You can only stop one for one turn, but that can be really important if that is the turn that Rasheth wants to feat, you know, and he wants to do as much damage as possible. And if you make it so only one of the turtles can be effective on that turn, then that can sometimes be enough. So it definitely has some counterplay into Guidance, but it's not quite so reliable. I think in that kind of situation, what you're trying to do is you're trying to position your army to be super relevant in scenario, protected by clouds, where Ruin will buy you enough time to force engagement, right, on your terms, because they can't disregard the scenario.
Okay. And is that one of the weaknesses of the DM list, when we talked about last week? The idea that outside of Gremlin Swarms, it's a brick. It's going to stay in the central place. And if you start taking away some of the Gremlin Swarms, you start taking away ways to contest, it can make it very difficult for the DM player.
Yeah, it's definitely a big weakness. It's something I want to talk about in detail, but you're right that in this particular matchup, one of the challenges for the DM player is that Winds of Death is got a lot of tools for killing Gremlin Swarms. Right. Mm-hmm. Between the Guidance and the Cyclops Shamans and the ability to arc with Rasheth, they have no problem killing any number of Gundam Swarms almost anywhere on the table. So that can make scenario much more challenging.
Mm. Okay. So you've thoroughly shut my point down about the King of Nothing there. Well done. That's great.
I think it's really interesting. King of Nothing is a really cool skew, and he's different enough that you could run his Dark Menagerie list side by side with a different caster also in Dark Menagerie and have a strong pair, which is cool. Yeah.
Just for record, by the way, with Shamans, it's a common mistake. I feel public service coming into effect here. Ghost Shot doesn't ignore stealth. It's line of sight concealment and cover only. It's a common mistake of people thinking Ghost Shot can shoot Gremlin Swarms. You'd have to Guidance the Shaman as well.
Yep.
So generally, it's just the fact he's got a magical gun that you can put Guidance on, but it's still going to be two models a turn that can shoot Gremlin Swarms, which is usually enough, but you know, small victories.
Yeah, no, the reason I think it's good is because in a lot of scenarios, you have to have some Gremlin Swarms near the enemy army, you know, because you need to contest their zones.
So they can just walk up and shoot.
Yeah, the Shamans tend to be chilling out in those distant rectangular zones anyway, and then they can just advance and shoot the Gremlins.
Which they loved it.
Yep.
Cool.
One of the things that's not just with King of Nothing, it's just like positioning. It's obviously very important in every game of War Machine, but it comes up a lot more even through my few games with Grimkin. It's just like positioning poorly hurts this faction a lot more than some of the other ones I've played, I feel like. I don't know if that's just similar with your experience, Pat.
I think it's definitely true. I learned so much about positioning through playing Grimkin that I hadn't considered before, because misplacing a single model can often just lose you the game. And I think it comes down to what we talked about last time when we discussed Grimkin, which is one of their biggest weaknesses in this theme is the army is very slow. It's not very maneuverable. And you'd only have very few models. So when you have this army that's low model count and slow, you have to position every single model in the place to be relevant to enact your game plan, but also be relevant to scenario. Because if your models are too far away from a scenario zone, they're never going to get there. You can't quickly fix a mistake with your positioning. And if your opponent can block you or push you out of a zone or capitalize on the fact you've got very few models, then you can end up in a losing situation because you don't have a lot of cheap units that can just run and contest things. You know, you don't have a volume of fast models that can just get in the way and buy you time.
What are some of the positioning mistakes? You mentioned there some of them about just not being able to get to the scenario, but are there any position mistakes that someone playing into Grimkin can look out for and try and capitalize on?
Yeah, it's not just scenario, that's for sure. Like, the thing about the Dark Menagerie theme in particular is you have these large footprint slow models that have these important overlapping buff effects, right? You've got your Death Knell that sits in the center of your army that gives an armor aura to everything around it. You've got your Cage Ragers that sit in front of that that give Arcane Vortex to everything within 3 inches of them. And then somewhere in the middle, nestled, you have your Krabbits that have a 3-inch range for Shield Guard, right? And once you're stacking your armor bonus, your Shield Guards, and your Arcane Vortexes, then the list becomes hugely resilient against all kinds of different things in the game. So you have to worry about that positioning, where all of your models have to be positioned relative to each other to protect each other. And ideally, you want to create a situation where literally every model in your list has access to all of those buffs, and ideally multiple vortexes and multiple shield guards if the matchup requires it. Yeah. So that can be really, really tough, and it can be something to exploit as soon as you see a Grimkin player has put a model out of position.
Mm.
You know, something I often see is a Grimkin player will put one Skinner Moans on a flank because they feel like that flank is weak, but then that Skinner Moans isn't benefiting from any of those buffs. And a Skinner Moans without that support is really not very strong at all, right? He's 13, 17. It's basically got the stats for light. And as soon as an important model strays out of those auras, then they can just get taken apart really easily by shooting or by high threat range models. Their damage output doesn't need to be that high to really punish the Grimkin player.
Yeah, I agree. One of the things we talked about last week was the idea that with Arcana, you have to accept that you're going to spend resource to make or give the option for the Grimkin player to use an Arcana, and that's okay. And you shouldn't be scared of quote unquote wasting a spell if they have Ruin. Actually, that's just a resource trade like anything else in the game. I find same thing looking at positioning is that players will look around a Grimkin table, and one of the things to keep an eye on is which models are in which of those ranges. So how many shield guards is on that particular model? Is a Cage Rager nearby, and is it within a Death Knell range?
Mm-hmm.
If everything is perfect, then you don't have an obvious opening there. However, the next thing to look for, which I think people give up on, is that because they look at the term and go, oh, that's all in the claw over there, I won't bother. But actually, it's very difficult to get, for instance, two shield guards and a Cage Rager onto one model. So just accept that one's going to be shield guarded and then focus on that one model. So it's looking at the best options that you have and accepting that the Grimkin player is not going to give you great ones, and just take what you can from the table. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
Another thing I see sometimes is because the Death Knell's range is buffed by the corpse tokens, so sometimes you see players position their models in outside of the current range of the Death Knell's, and because they expect some number of models to die, and then so they assume it's like, so I believe the Death Knell's base range is 5 with the 4 plus the 1 corpse, so sometimes you will see people position, I would say, aggressively, like they want their Skinnamones to be able to exert pressure on, like, this, say, the hoe zone. So they'll position the Skinnamones, let's say, like 6 to 7 inches in front of the Death Knell, just because of maybe they put, like, sometimes people play with a unit of Dreadrots, so they run the Dreadrots in front really aggressively forward to, like, because they think that they will definitely kill the Dreadrots, so I'll be able to collect the, like, corpses, and then my Skinnamones will be in the armor aura. Where sometimes that works because people usually are not the best at denying obvious, like, I'm not gonna say trap, but just like easy is like easy baits. It's just like you have pop, like most armies have pop guns. Like when I say pop guns, like range, like POW 10 ish range power, and it's like, oh, there's some Dreadrots in front of me, I should just shoot them. Because in their mind, right, like, if I don't make the shots, I'm, like, wasting potentials of my army. Where it's usually fine, but in this case, you should look at the big picture. It's like, all right, so their heavy is not in the armor aura, and if I don't kill their light infantry model, we can just put a lot of, like, chip damage onto their heavy, and then next turn I can maybe use my feet or some, maybe go, like, really deep and try to go pick up the half damage heavy and maybe another one.
Yeah, that's such a good point. You raised two things there I think's really valid. The Death Knell range, I think there's two ranges. There's the armor range, which you've mentioned, and I don't see people routinely checking to see if things are in or out, especially if it's close. But I think you should be knowing exactly what's in or out of all these different buffs on the Grimkin player's side. I think the next thing to look for in terms of corpse collection, which I used to make loads of mistakes on, is when you have a Death Knell and they've positioned some of the Dread Rods outside the corpse collection range. I'd prefer just to kill those and give them no corpses and leave some Dread Rots in range to maybe, you know, charge me or whatever, rather than give them corpses. It's very unlikely that one or two Dread Rots are going to cause you a massive headache, especially because most DM lists don't have a huge amount of ranged output. So if the Dread Rots come forward and then charge, they're usually almost outside of the collection range no matter what. So I'd prefer to take them out in two chunks, take what you can without giving corpses, and then take the rest when they commit the Dread Rots, rather than shooting what's in front of you, especially if you don't feel you can dig deep enough to shoot heavies. Because the extra armor and the extra strength on Skin and Moans I find is so big, and the extra corpses for Cage Rager, I prefer to take two charges from a couple of Dreadrots I've left alive for a turn, rather than give two corpses to any one of the Grimkin player's army, because it has such a big impact on the game, those two spell negations or the +2 strength, +2 armor. Pat, from your side of the table playing, is that a fair comment? Do you think that's a reasonable approach to take? Or do you just
Yeah, it's completely correct. You're spot on. Like, and that's not even one thing you didn't mention there. I know we discussed it before, but is on top of that, you have Arcana to consider, right? So when you think about all of the ways that the Grimkin player is essentially rewarded for you killing those Dreadrots, a lot of Arcana trigger on warrior models. They get the corpses, which buff their armor aura, and then those in turn get given to the heavies, which buff the heavies the following turn. It's often just not worth killing the Dreadrots. Now, as the Grimkin player, the way that you leverage that is you put the Dreadrots in places where your opponent's hands are tied, right? And you try to set up a situation where if they don't kill them, the retaliation isn't something that they can easily accommodate, right? Because I agree with you. If you're in a situation where you're like, well, if I ignore these Dreadrots, then two of them charge a heavy and I take a little bit of damage, it's fine. Then, as a Grimkin player, I've done something wrong. I need to have them in a position where either you have to kill them for scenario, or you have to kill them to get charge lanes on my heavies, or if you don't kill them, they will kill something that's high value. And that's what you should be planning for with those Dreadrots, is to try and get the most out of them and force your opponent into a situation where they don't want to kill them, but they're punished either way.
Yeah. I wonder if there's a scenario where it's worth giving up a heavy to take away all of the corpses and all Dreadrots for one game. It sounds bad, but maybe. Depends what else you've got in your army, I guess. So let's say the Grimkin player positions perfectly and they have the Dreadrots all within collection range and all within Arcana range, whereby two things happen. There are no easy targets that we talked about, but also they're in a position whereby they can threaten a meaningful piece. Because they're Power 10 Weapon Masters, so with a damage buff, they potentially will be able to take a heavy out, as you say. I wonder if there's a scenario where actually just losing a heavy to take all the corpses off the table is a worthwhile trade. I think it comes down to how important are those corpses over the course of the game. It feels like they're very important because of the aura and the death knell and the armor buff, and that obviously multiplies every attack you put into a skin of moans or whatever. But it feels bad just letting a heavy get taken off the board by some Dreadrot.
Yeah, definitely good point. I think it's probably not often that it's worth it, but there I can see some scenarios where it is, especially if your list is otherwise good at denying corpses. So if, for example, you're playing War Machine and you're running Jack Heavy, so your models don't give corpses when they die, if you're playing Convergence, if you're not planning on killing Krabbits with shooting through their shield guards, or if you aren't especially good at killing gremlin swarms, you don't plan on taking them out till later in the game, then all those things can add up to mean that the Grimkin player isn't going to get many corpses, and that so denying more could be really, really important.
Cool. One of the things I found positionally, we talked about this brick and all of the models being within a certain range. A lot of Grimkin players will have that deployment and the positioning at least in their heads fixed as to what they need to happen, and then they get to a table or get to a tournament and there is a very well placed house in the middle of the board. So I think, Pat, you've been playing a while, so Tom, with the games that you played when you first started playing, how did you find terrain affected positioning and just how the list played? Like, I imagine that type of big house just in front of your deployment zone that's blocking a corner of a scenario zone or something like that. Something really annoying, but quite common.
It was really difficult for me to like change, because prior to playing Grimkin, this was a while ago, I was playing Legion, which was a lot easier to position because all the lists I played had a lot of winged heavies, which buildings are perfect in those situations. Whereas playing Grimkin, because all your heavies are speed five or four, and then your army's depending on a battle engine that's a decent speed, but the aura is not as big at the beginning, it can make for very awkward choices when it comes to like a building, unless you're like playing the King of Nothing with the access to Ghostly. Because the thing about the building is, at least for me, because I like playing aggressive armies, I don't like the idea of if I put my beast behind in like a corner to like get the cover bonuses, sure, I'll be safe and be like very protected, but I won't be able to retaliate. So that's like a situation that if eventually drove me out of just trying to not play Grimkin as much, and because I don't like breaking up as much with the heavies. At least like not on the unmaneuverable heavies.
Yeah, it's definitely a tactic that you're somewhat forced into with most DM lists. Not always, but... and you're right that that positioning can be really, really difficult. Now that I've played Dark Menagerie a lot, I've found that I've overcome some of that with heuristics, right? Just like habits that I've formed to play my opening turns. And certainly terrain is critically important, especially that terrain that's in scenario zones or is blocking your way to those zones. And I will tend to have a plan now for where my heavies are going to be every single turn of the game. Because from turn two onwards, I will usually plan for most of my heavies to be in multiple zones. Like anytime there's a scenario where you can be contesting two areas at once, which I think is pretty much every scenario, I'll plan for all of those overlapping areas to have a heavy in them, right? And then I'll plan for the heavies around those to be contesting either or, right? Yeah. And then I'll plan for the Gremlin Swarms to be back up, right? Where they're either screening in front of the heavies to protect them from charges and also simultaneously contesting that same scenario element, or they're hanging out behind the heavies to remove fury from them and taking that scenario element that's behind the heavy. So I found that I basically need to plan my entire army's movement every turn just being on zones. And then I will only deviate from that plan if I have a really juicy target of opportunity and charge range. But my threat ranges being as low as they are, most players will not put things in my charge range. And so my plan is really simple. Stay in the zones, contest and score every turn, and force my opponent to come to me. Because if I'm not doing that, they've got no incentive to come to me, and they're just going to wear me down.
So you trying to use that against a Grimkin player, if you have a scenario where you can start the scoring first and by going second, and also if the table has terrain that makes deployment and advancing up very difficult for the Grimkin player, it feels like it's going to be the better option to go second and try and play a scenario game from turn one, whereby as long as you're doing what the Grimkin player wants to do, so you're scoring, clearing Gremlin Swarms with whatever you have, scoring your zone, contesting theirs, and scoring first, that feels like a better way to play into Grimkin than trying to play their game of coming into them and attrition, etc.
So I think that's a really good point, because I agree with you, but I don't think many people agree with us. As a Grimkin player, I almost always choose to go second, because I find that being the first to score and the last to score is huge because of my strategy, which is basically score a point a turn and stop you scoring anything. And being the first and last gives me some flexibility when my opponent can stop that plan, right? It means I can go down a couple of points, but still be able to enact that plan over seven turns, because my army can't score a lot of points in a single turn on almost any scenario, right? Because I'm too slow. I don't have enough units. I don't have enough threat ranges to clear zones. So I just have to settle for a point a turn. But discussing this with a lot of players, most people disagree, and they just tell me, well, going first is so big, it's just so important in this game, that even with that consideration, I still prefer to go first.
I think it's potentially because with going first, there's a conception, especially with slower armies, going first allows you to take board presence that you need to project threat. But how you're playing your list is such that you're not really projecting threat. You're playing in a way to force your opponent to come into you. So actually your threat range is relevant. You're playing a game accepting that you'll be out-threated. But this is where positioning and Gremlin Swarms and Dreadrots or whatever else you're using and potentially terrain is really important, because it means that you're not losing too much on attrition. So if you don't lose on attrition and you're going second, speed and table presence don't actually matter, because you're not looking to get across the table. I'm guessing most of your games, Pat, you're very rarely past the halfway line. You'll be edge of the scenario zones, just clearing, scoring points, etc. Apart from Gremlin Swarms, which run away and do stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll be hugging whatever scenario elements are on my side of the table that I can clear every turn, and then I'll just be advancing far enough forward to contest the pieces that are on my opponent's side. I mean, so that is often just the halfway line.
And Tom, you're known as an aggressive player, not known for the seven turn grinds. When you were playing Grimkin, did you play the DM list differently to how Pat plays it? Did you have a kind of a different macro strategy on the list?
Yes, my preferred caster for Grimkin was always the child. because she can change the pace a little bit, because she, I like to play her very aggressively, where she's usually the most forward model in accepting like a couple of Grimmen Swarms around to contest. She's usually as far forward as I can make her without getting her killed. Because I like alphaing and then like dictating and making them respond to me instead of the other way around.
Cool.
Yeah, I think that's really cool.
Which works to an extent.
Well, what I wanted to say is I talked a bit before about the different strengths that casters bring to the Dark Menagerie list, right? And one of the things that I think is really cool about the child is her unique gimmick is she is probably the best caster in the faction for winning scenarios. Like Dreamer's Phantasms will mean you don't lose scenarios very often, but the child has the highest threat ranges that she can put on a lot of models because she can cast Abuse multiple times. But then she also has Bulldoze, she has Force Hammer, and because she can play so far forward, she can project Arcana into more relevant pieces for scenario. So I'm not surprised that you played that strategy with Child, because she seems like she's the best equipped for it.
Yeah. It's interesting going back to the caster breakdown at the beginning, where we talk through some of the typical hallmarks of list building, defensive buffs, anti-gun line, at cracking armor. After talking through DM in a bit more detail, it feels like the casters are not around the tools, but much more how you play the list. So you've got the Child and the King of Nothing that are much more aggressive, King of Nothing being minus two armor himself and probably no death knell. So arguably for some models a minus four armor string compared to other DM builds. And both of those are designed to project threat, put your opponent in difficult decisions and get further up, either using a child's threat range and abuse or by using King Nothing's clouds. Whereas Dreamer and Heretic are much more part your style of play, which is sit back, seven turn grinds, going for attrition, and if you give me a big option to get up in an area, I'll break out my game plan, but if not, I'm just going to wear you down over seven turns.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I really love both those casters because they do that game plan, but in different ways, and you can tailor them depending on the meta, right? So the first really strong competitive list that I built for Grimkin was Heretic Dark Menagerie. It was one of the two that I took to WTC alongside Dreamer Dark Menagerie, actually. Surprise, surprise. And the thing that I found really worked well with that list is Heretic has great tools for stopping aggressive infantry, right? Because he's got Wall of Fire, which you can use to easily screen one or multiple heavies from a charge, especially when you combine it with terrain. And he's got Rebuke, which you can cast on a unit to stop orders, so you can stop charges. And those combined with Arcana, like Pandemonium or Labyrinth, meant that he can just shut down an entire army of Weapon Masters, right? You can create a situation, and I've had this playing Heretic against, for example, Vindictus with Exemplars, or Dark Host in Crix. I've had situations where an entire army of 40 Weapon Masters, none of them can charge, right? They don't have a single angle to get onto a heavy. So that's obviously really, really strong. And then his game plan is advance forwards, survive, because none of those guys are charging me. And without charges, they can't do enough damage to my armor 21 heavies, yeah, and grind. Whereas Dreamer doesn't have that going for her, but she has really good control against heavier targets because she can put down rough terrain with Abyssal Gate. What's it called? Artifice of Deviation. She can protect herself against guns better with that same spell. And then she can create phantasms, which are really, really good for blocking large bases.
Makes sense. And there's a video, I think there's one of the WTCs, I think, of you playing Heretic. I'm not sure if that was recorded, actually, so it wasn't. I definitely know there's one of you playing into Jonas's Denny One Scourge end of last year. And that's really interesting to watch. I think it's one where he goes for a last gasp assassination on you because you just grinded everything else down over a period of time. So you looked at the matchup, especially with ambushing units, it looked rough. But actually, the models stayed exactly where you said they would be. Infantry just kept on getting thrown in or shut down, rebuked or fired. And every turn, only a few models could get charges on. And with your placement, it was never enough to do enough damage to one round of heavy. And then you had things like the corpses and the D3 healing on corpses with skin and bones who would just sit and kill each, you know, three or four infantry a turn. So I think that's on YouTube. It might be worth posting a link up, or just go to YouTube and search. I can't remember what it was. I think, was it CogCon last year you played Yonasset?
Yeah, I played him at CogCon.
Yeah, but I think that, I don't know if you'd agree if that's a good example of this in action, but I certainly thought it was pretty impressive to watch you take it apart.
Yeah, definitely. There's another good example from Conquest in Norway, where I play against Exemplar theme in Menoth, and a similar thing happened. Mm. That matchup is really good for Grimkin, but only if you're positioned like we talked about before, where you're getting all of your defensive buffs, you're using terrain to block charges, and you're using the defensive tech from your caster on top of that. And like you said, Rich, the key is it's okay for one or two models to charge you, because individual infantry aren't going to do enough damage to a heavy, and you can heal with your corpses and with Sacrifice Arcana. So you just create a situation where no one heavy can be charged by too much, and then you can just grind them down.
Yeah. So again, going back to positioning, that's something to look at, is do you have any options? I think Tommy mentioned as well about just digging deep and taking out one heavy or committing to an area. If you can pull that off, obviously, great, go for it. Sounds simple, right? Just if you can kill a heavy, kill it.
I mean, I will say that I think one of the things that is really good against Dark Menagerie is when you can create, if you've got those infantry swarms that can put in enough damage to reliably kill a heavy. And what you want to be looking for is you want to be looking for infantry that hit really hard, but also have reach, so that you can get a lot more of them into a smaller area. And you want to be looking for terrain situations where you can get an actual like surround on a heavy. So you can, for example, if you can hit 8 Satixis or 8 IFP into a heavy, then you have a decent chance of killing it.
Yeah.
And as the Grimkin player, obviously you want to stop that happening, and you want to use obstacles and walls and spells and gremlin swarms and even lights and krabbits if you have to, just to stop a lot of infantry or concentrating on one target.
Yeah. Something you've mentioned there, going back to corpses, is on the flip side, if you're playing against a non-shooting list, so like IFP, using things like Krabbits as blocking lanes, but also as bait to bring a few models in, and also have a way to guarantee corpses from your side, find works really well, especially if you can then shield the model you've sent to kill a few of the IFP with things like a wall of fire, works really well. I found that really difficult to deal with when you had models like a Frightmare that have come forwards. You can't leave it there because it's just going to start putting the corrosion AoEs down and ruining your life. But if you start sending IFP off to kill it, you're reducing, even if you only send like 4 or 5 or half a unit, you're reducing the output of being able to kill a heavy later on, because you know those 4 or 5 will die, and it gets pretty horrible. So I don't see many Grimkin players leading with their lights and Krabbits. It's one of the things that is similar to terrain. A lot of Grimkin players seem to have the way that they play and where the models go, and it never changes. And actually recognizing when you need to change up your configuration and have lights leading first or Krabbits leading first and not within 3 of your beasts, etc. I think that feels like a key skill on the Grimkin player's side to nail.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It can be tough to think that way, especially because we kind of condition ourselves in War Machine sometimes to, my model is in this army for this reason, so it's going to do this thing.
Yeah.
But that is often not what you need it to do. So I will often have Frightmares block, just because there's no good shooting targets to mid the matchup. Krabbits, like you said, are perfect for this. I think they're actually really underrated. And I've started to consider just taking fewer Gremlin Swarms and more Krabbits, because Krabbits do a much better job of blocking because they're much more resilient, right? They got 13 boxes instead of 5. Mm. And if people attack with magic weapons, then the Gremlins disappear really quickly. But then on top of all that, once again, you've got to consider your Arcana, and you want to create this screen of models that not only is really hard to clear, but also lets you trigger a defensive Arcana before they can reach your heavies. One of the things that's still great about the Gremlin Swarms is, as warrior models, you can use them to trigger Ill Omens, which is the Arcana that gives the entire opposing army -1 to attack and damage rolls. So if you can create a situation where your Gremlins are screening your heavies and they have to commit resources to kill the Gremlins first, not only can they not use those resources to kill your heavy, but you can also trigger Ill Omens and make it even harder to kill your heavies after that.
Makes a lot of sense. So then, going back to casters, we talked through King of Nothing in the Child. DM builds how they play, which is very much on Tom's playstyle, which is a lot more aggressive and force engagement. We've got Dreamer and Heretic, which are much more deliver your army, protect, control the game, and attrition. Where do the Wanderer and Witch 3 fit into this?
So I think the Wanderer is also on that spectrum of control the game and attrition, right? He controls the game by having the best defensive buffs. And I don't know, I don't think a lot of people subscribe to this theory, but I often just consider defense as another form of control, because all control really is your models can't do what they want to do. And in War Machine, most of your models just want to kill my models. And if I make it so my models are really tough, you can't kill my models, and your models don't do anything.
This sounds like a Sylvester Stallone, like, motivational speech.
It's like, for example, Striker 1's feat is an awesome control feat. My army gets +5 armor. It doesn't matter what your models do next turn. And so Wanderer, giving his whole army concealment and Starcrossed, can be really, really powerful in doing exactly the same thing as Heretic's Wall of Fire or Dreamer's Artifice, which is it stops models killing you. Now, I'm personally a little less of a fan of it, just because Starcrossed is a dice manipulation mechanic. So when you're using it, you're relying on luck, right? If I use a Wall of Fire to stop a bunch of Doom Reavers charging my heavy, then that's guaranteed. I place the Wall of Fire, I know those 4 Doom Reavers aren't reaching my heavy. But if I rely on Starcrossed, well, maybe they'll miss, maybe they won't. You know?
Yeah.
And I have to cross my fingers. But where it really shines is if you can combine it with other things that stop attacks as well, right? So if I'm using all my high defense screening models, like my Lights, my Krabbits, my Gremlin Swarms, and my opponent has to choose for those first, then Starcrossed is pulling double duty, right? Because it's protecting all those models, making them last longer, and then protecting the heavies once those models are finally cleared.
Tom, did you play Wanderer when you were on Grimkin?
Yeah, I think the best thing about that caster, especially in his final form, is just baiting people into bad assassinations.
Fair enough. So it feels like he's one of the guys that we don't see. Maybe because we saw the other four really good.
Yeah, he's reasonably popular. I don't think I give him enough credit. I've been forcing myself to play him a bit more recently, and I do appreciate he has some cool stuff. Like Tom said, he's super hard to assassinate because of his Trump Arcana that lets him teleport away. I really like his out-of-activation movement shenanigans with his road markers, and they can let you do some interesting things. The thing that sets him apart for me is... he has some more interesting or surprising plays than other casters, because he's got his beacon, his spray, that everything it hits gets flared and gets beacon on it. So they're easier to hit, they're easier to target, and you can charge further. And because you can put that spray basically wherever you like because of road markers, you can get it in places your opponent doesn't necessarily expect. But on top of that, you have Veil of Mist, which lets you move through models. So he can beacon unexpected things and also create ways for your models to get to them. And so he is better than most at scalping out key pieces. One of the things that Dark Menagerie can struggle with is in grindy games where it's fighting other bricks, it kind of just has to attack whatever's in front of it. And you can play this game where you're just slugging it out over a long series of turns, grinding each other down. And Wanderer can break that by letting you kind of go through that front line and attack really important key pieces, or even just get an assassination out of nowhere if your opponent isn't expecting it.
Yeah. Also, just a quick note about Veil of Mist, and which is a really funny interaction of the counter charge. Because it is a cloud template, like the obvious train of thought everyone sees that goes through people's mind when they see the cloud template, it's like, oh, I can't see across of it, and he can't see across of me. So when you layer that together with the counter charge, you can randomly get a lot of value out of it.
And that's because with Veil of Mist, the cloud specifically only blocks line of sight for your opponent, right?
Yeah. and it lets you move through buildings and models, obviously. So what you can sometimes do is just like put Veil of Mist like in like a really obnoxious way, like in like a corner of a building, So if the Rattler with a counter charge and can like counter charge through the building when it sees your guy and put the Rattler in like really obnoxious places, and then the next turn like potentially can go like munch through a bunch of infantry that your opponent did not see that was possible.
Really cool.
Yeah.
One of the things I like doing with the Wanderer as well in similar lines is if there is something like a building, like a big obstacle in a key place in the board, then I will try my hardest to get a Skin and Moans right behind that obstacle, because I can project a 12-inch threat with Beacon all around it, and that can often force people out of zones while the Skin and Moan stays really safe, because it can move through the obstacle with Veil of Mist, but things can't get to it.
Yeah, I can see that. That's really annoying.
Yeah. He might be the best caster in Grimkin at exploiting Colossal with terrain, because you can always usually see a Colossal through whatever's terrain. So with Veil of Mist and like putting it in front of a Skin of Mones, and then with the Beacon and his spray, you can very easily set up a situation where your heavies charge a flared Colossal through like a building. And the Colossal can't really get away from it, because normally when you play a list with Colossal, it's like center point of your army. So that thing either has A, do a lot of work, and B, contest like important scenario zones, because it's such an expensive commitment.
Yeah. I think Colossals in general are really bad against Grimkin for that reason, right? Grimkin tend not to care very much about their guns and tend to be able to kill them with heavies very, very easily for their points.
Yep.
Cool. And then the last one we've got up is Witch 3. How does she fit into DM? Or is this a don't?
No, I don't. Yeah, go on.
Wow. I love this episode.
Maybe we'll have a difference of opinions.
So normally you don't think about Witch 3 in DM, because the classic train of thought is DM, couple heavies, a death knell. So you already, and because of the death knell, already takes up a lot of space and your heavies need to be around it. So generally, you can't really fit another huge base into that formula. And it's mostly true. You generally don't want to play Witch 3 in Dark Menagerie. Unless in very, very few specific matchups.
Which are?
Yeah. Well, actually, so here's where I disagree, which is I think Witch is fantastic in Dark Menagerie. And I agree, the death knell is a problem, but it's not an insurmountable one. I think, like King of Nothing, there's an argument to say that you can play Old Witch in Dark Menagerie without a death knell, just because it makes your positioning so much easier when you don't have these two huge bases that both want to be in the center of the table just behind your army. And with Windstorm, you can protect yourself enough from guns that... in a lot of matchups, you don't necessarily need the death knell armor buff because you've got enough survivability against what they're taking anyway. But I had played her with a death knell, and it's okay. Now, I say that knowing that I've lost several games purely because her and a death knell couldn't exist in the same space at the same time. And I've had situations where she's got assassinated because there was a wall in my half of the table and I couldn't get her where I needed to go because the death knell was in the way and she got charged by like 3 halberdiers and died. But it is possible to position her so that her and the death knell are kind of side by side. And the nice thing about running her in Dark Menagerie is she has art nodes. So she doesn't need to be as central as she might need to be in Bump, where she's the person slinging her spells with a bonus range. So you can do it. But I agree with Tom that the main reason you would want to is if you want to tech for certain matchups.
Is that just the obvious ones, like the heavy gun lines, where Chef probably doesn't like to see Witch 3? And then there's also things like Nemo, stuff like that. Is it basically the heavy anti-gun lines that you're teching against?
Yep.
Yes. To expand on Tom's answer, it is, but especially ones that don't have so much range that they can ignore Windstorm. So if you have a gun line that has access to snipe, then it's less optimal to drop Witch.
It's a good job that's not around in the game at the minute.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly wouldn't make a solo that has that on a stick. So nothing to worry about there.
Spoilers.
On top of that, if they have combined arms, one of the weaknesses of which is her army is less resilient against melee because she doesn't have Arcana. And Arcana like Sacrifice, Ill Omens, Pandemonium, Labyrinth all help you against melee damage. And she doesn't have any of that. So she is a bit weaker against the combined armed options, but really good against the heavy gun lines. Special mention, she has a really good toolbox for dealing with Hayley 3 because she has access to... well, one of the cool things about her in Grimkin, as opposed to Kador, is she has access to Animi. Mm. And one of her abilities is she makes spells one cheaper. So she can cast all these Animi on herself, often for no cost. So she can give herself True Sight from a Frightmare and shoot through clouds. She can scourge through clouds. She has her 4-inch AoE that causes blind, which screws over trenches, but is great for debuffing the echoes in Hayley and making them easy to kill. Scourge is also great against the echoes. She has access to Wraithbane that she can cast at one cost, which is fantastic against echoes, but it's also fantastic for killing trenches. You can Wraithbane a Rattler and send it in and kill a lot of trenches. like a lot of trenches.
That makes me so happy.
Yeah, especially if you are running the Death Knell, so you can remove healing. And on her feat turn, one of her great abilities is her battle group rerolls attack rolls. So her Rattlers are just superb. With Boundless Charge, rerolled attacks, access to Animi, they can just kill everything. I think she probably has the best Rattlers in the game, even better than Dreamers. Hmm. So she has these different layers of tech that make her really good against Hayley 3, right? She stops Hayley 3 shooting, which is a very large part of Gravedigger lists. She has access to Wraithbane, to ignore clouds, and to multiple ways to reduce defense on top of Wraithbane. So she has all kinds of great tools for that matchup.
Which is generally why you would take her in Dark Menagerie.
Yeah, it's very much a silver bullet list. It's fine for all comers, but like I said, less good probably on balance as an all-comer list than with other casters, but still good and really, really strong for that matchup.
Cool. Good stuff. So we talked through all the casters, or the lock, sorry. We've talked through some of the key positioning bits, and some of those are really interesting and definitely ones to take away to the table. Are there any other final thoughts on the DM list, any key positioning bits, or any just general points that we want to wrap up with on the list, or are we all ready to go away and smash everyone?
There's a couple of things that I just wanted to mention. I don't think they're as important, but they are key things to think about. One of them is target priority. So in this list, one of the weaknesses you have is low threat range and low volume of attacks and low number of ranged attacks. What this means is you're really bad at picking out key targets. You don't have good ways to scalpel targets. So whenever you do, you need to plan really carefully how you're going to spend your attacks. And often you will only get one or two long ranged attacks a turn, and it will probably be like arcing a spell through a Cage Rager or making the one attack with your Frightmare or your Leaping Crabbit, you know? So you need to pick your targets really carefully, and you need to be looking for opportunities to take out key support models or solos. I mean, so many theme lists now run those like 5 or 6 point combat solos that also buff the models around them, right? That's like a staple in themes. So be on the lookout for how you can take out those models, because you won't have very many ways to do it. And you might have to engineer your turn specifically around how you're going to scalpel key pieces. The other thing that I just wanted to mention as a final thought is Fury management. Fury is a big problem because you're running a list that's almost entirely Warbeast. You have Carianna Rose and you have Gremlin Swarms that can both help reduce Fury. But you really have to think carefully about how you use Fury. And you can't just buy attacks with all your heavies every turn, because you will lose out on value in the long run. One of the mistakes I made a lot, and I still do it because it's a common thing to do as a Hordes player, and it doesn't work so well for Grimkin. And that is often, as a Hordes player, you'll run hot because you'll expect your heavies to die, right? And you can cheat on Fury, because you can send in three heavies, only have enough Fury to remove from two, but know that one is going to die. So it doesn't matter which one dies, I'll take Fury from the other two and I'll be fine. A nice problem to have with Grimkin, but a problem nevertheless, is often your heavies don't die. and you run them all in, and then they frenzy, and you've actually come out behind because they've survived, but you've got no benefit from them surviving because they frenzied.
Okay.
So you see what I mean? So I've had to train myself to not run as hot with Grimkin as I would do with other Hordes factions, because I'm simultaneously doing everything in my power to stop my heavies from dying. So I need to make sure that they're doing work every single turn while they're alive, and not going like on off as they go between, you know, spending all their fury and then frenzying.
That's interesting. So do you think that's something to... sorry, Tom, do you want to go ahead?
I was just going to say, that's like the nicest way to phrase the most first world problem ever.
Yes.
Oh my god, I kill all their stuff. My stuff didn't die, so I have all these fury left over. What am I going to do?
Okay. So with that in mind, something that popped up is I've seen players assume that their Gremlin Swarms will still be alive to help manage fury. So Gremlin Swarms have Serenity, yeah? Yeah, so it might be a situation of if you think you can kill a heavy, but then they can just drop the fury, actually leave the heavies, maybe give them something that's awkward for them to kill or get around. So if they don't frenzy or whatever, they don't kill your ship, and then just focus on killing the Gremlin Swarms. So you're taking away the plan of the Grimkin player not frenzying based on Gremlin Swarms frenzying. Just kill the Gremlin Swarms only, leave the beast, let them all frenzy, and then you've got a turn to kill them all. And it feels like that could be better, just going back to what we're talking about positioning. If a beast frenzies, it's obviously got a charge, it's got a move. It's going to be a lot harder for you to make sure all of your defensive tech's in the right place if you can't control where your models go.
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest advantage you can get against the Dark Menagerie list for frenzies is pulling things out of their protective auras, like you just said, and also having them charge out of the zones they were contesting. And if you can't do enough damage to kill those heavies, which is probably why they're living in frenzying in the first place, then you can plan to instead, if the Grimkin player runs hot, plan to exploit the frenzies and try to get them into unfavorable positions. I had one particularly bad game recently at the WCC practice event up in York. No, in wherever we had it, in Element Games. In Stockport, where I had a Cage Rager frenzy into IFP, Iron Fang Pikeman. He charged an Iron Fang Pikeman and killed it, but he charged outside of the Death Knell's aura into a position where he could be countercharged by all the Great Bears. Yeah, that one frenzy almost lost me the game on the spot, right? Because I basically just gave my opponent a free heavy.
Wow.
where he frenzied out of the zone, out of the aura, and then got killed out of activation.
I have no sympathy at all. That's
that was pretty great.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Thanks for that, helpful. Cool. Tom, anything from you on final thoughts on DM?
People should play the child more. That's my conclusion.
Play the child more. Smash face. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds reasonable.
All of the casters are really good, and the child is pretty underrated. Even though I personally favour Dreamer and Heretic, and I often take that to events, I honestly think any caster in Grimkin in Dark Menagerie is a competitive choice, and one that you should think about when you're making your pair.
Cool. Sounds good. Well, thanks for sharing some insight this week, Pat. Hopefully everyone's found it useful, and hopefully we don't have a load of Grimkin players crying next week when everything gets torn apart at the tables.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thanks so much, everyone.
Cool. Till next time.
Bye.